The Marshall Plan was when America's national ideals were given expression in our foreign policy. It was America at its best, a time in which our foreign policy at once advanced our strategic interests and reflected our moral leadership and the best of our national ideals.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Miller Center Forum. It's a particular personal pleasure to introduce Greg Berman to talk about his new book, The Most Noble Adventure, The Marshall Plan and the Time When America Helped Save Europe. Years and years ago, I did my senior honors thesis at Columbia University on the economic origins of the Marshall Plan. And as I said to Greg Berman, not altogether jokingly, when I wrote this, it was current events, not history. Now he's writing it as history in a very well-reviewed and engaging history. Greg Berman is a very interesting person, and I hope he'll share some of his adventures with us. He's a mountain climber. He's a runner. But he's also a graduate of Princeton University, where he was a magna cum laude graduate, and he has a master's degree from Oxford University. He has been spending most of his time the past few years, when not writing, at the Aspen Institute, and he has recently accepted appointment to the Carr Center at the Kennedy School at Harvard University. Please welcome Greg Berman.
Thank you for the generous introduction, and it's wonderful to be with all of you here this afternoon. As mentioned, this book, The Most Noble Adventure, tells the story of the Marshall Plan. It's a $13 billion program to help promote economic recovery in Western Europe after World War II, and it takes place against the backdrop of the post-war period. And after World War II, Europe was absolutely eviscerated. The continent lost, in terms of death, a population roughly equivalent and possibly in excess of the entire pre-war population of France. Ancient cities, celebrated cities, were leveled. Beyond the death and the physical destruction, there was intense commercial and financial dislocation. The traditional trading patterns which had governed Europe's economic patterns and system were undone. And of course, just shortly a year or two after this sort of near cataclysmic fratricide, there was a prevailing sense of dispiritedness. There was the view amongst many that capitalism had sort of failed the continent. It was perceived to have helped lead to the global depression of the 1930s. It was viewed to have been feeding the fascist states during World War II, feeding what they called the Nazi warfare state. And now it was viewed to have been failing the continent during its post-war economic ills. National communist parties were finding fuel in these conditions and were emerging and gaining in political popularity. And in France, and even in countries like France and Italy, were threatening to emerge and assume power peacefully via the ballot box. Of course, to the east, a new superpower, a new totalitarian power emerges in the form of the Soviet Union with expansionist designs on the continent. The Marshall Plan was America's response to these great strategic challenges, the challenges of that moment. I also think, in a larger sense, it's the story about how America responded to the post-war moment, this seminal moment in world history. It's a story about how America chose to exercise its newfound power during that time, and really about what sort of country we wanted to be, what sort of modern superpower we wanted to be. Much of the book is the shared story of six American statesmen, the people who I would argue were indispensable to the genesis and the execution of the plan. George Marshall in my view, as the central figure of the plan. He had a military career that spanned 45 years. He was Army Chief of Staff for 6 years before and during World War II with Olympian responsibilities. When he was inducted in that position on September 1st, 1939, that's the same day that Germany invaded Poland. At that point, the American military was ranked about 19th in the world, somewhere around Portugal and Bulgaria. Marshall was the key military figure. He really created the modern American military. He was the most respected, the most revered man of his time, and I think since. We must remember that the celebrated generals, the commanding generals, Eisenhower, Patton, MacArthur, they reported to Marshall. Eisenhower was a protege, and Eisenhower once said, I wouldn't trade 50 Douglas MacArthurs for one George Marshall. And then he sort of had a moment to think, and he said, on second thought, that would be a rotten trade. What would you do with 50 MacArthurs? So Truman summons Marshall out of retirement for the second time in what, in my view, may be one of the best decisions of his presidency, to come and bring his great strategic judgment and vision and prestige to bear as Secretary of State. A few months later, Marshall leaves a dramatic late-night meeting in the Kremlin with Joseph Stalin, and he determines that, in fact, the U.S. cannot achieve cooperation or partnership with its wartime ally, that Stalin is purposely letting Western Europe slide to reap the strategic gain. On the airplane ride back, he talks to his colleagues about the need to do something bold and decisive and to put forward an unprecedented program for Western Europe's economic recovery. When he gets back to Washington, he mobilizes an unusually talented group of diplomats to set the plan in motion, people like George Kennan and Dean Acheson, amongst others. Will Clayton was one of the great success stories in 20th century America. Clayton was from Tupelo, Mississippi. He had an eighth grade education. Eventually, he became the country's leading cotton merchant, a multimillionaire. And Clayton was one of these dollar-a-year men, what they called dollar-a-year men, a captain of industry who left his position, a very lucrative position in the economic sector, to come into government during World War II to help with the war effort and would not accept any salary. And Clayton is appointed by FDR as Undersecretary of State for Economic Affairs to manage the post-war world. And Clayton, in my view, is really the intellectual architect behind the plan. Arthur Vandenberg is a Republican senator from Michigan, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Van was an old newspaper editor, and he was famed for giving these long and dramatic speeches on the Senate floor with wild, florid prose. And he was known to sort of have all the affectations and all the histrionics of sort of the old parliamentary figures. But Van also had great political acumen, and he had great judgment. He added a lot of insights to the plan. And in a Republican-dominated Congress, the plan very much depended upon bipartisan support to secure its passage. And Vandenberg, possibly more than anyone else, made that possible. Paul Hoffman, Truman chose Paul Hoffman, a Republican in a Democratic administration, to run the Marshall Plan, to execute the plan. Hoffman dropped out of the University of Chicago after his freshman year to become a car salesman. And it turned out that he was pretty good at it. He was a millionaire by 34, and he eventually became president of the Studebaker Corporation. And in a time of salesmanship, you know, we must remember America came out of World War II with a roaring economy and roaring production. People were afraid, though, that we'd revert into the Depression, which we'd experienced in the 30s, or another post-war recession, as we did after World War I. And so the idea was very much to become the consumer republic, to spend our way out of recession. So salesmanship became hugely important. Around this time, Arthur Miller writes a play called Death of a Salesman. Around this time, Walt Disney comes out with a character by the name of Scrooge McDuck. To the idea is that miserliness is sort of a sin or a vice. And so in a time of salesmanship, Hoffman is the master salesman. He's extremely affable. He is engaging, articulate, self-effacing. He described Midwestern to his core is how he describes himself. And Hoffman, amongst his many responsibilities, was really selling the plan to European audience, to Congress, to the American public. And on one occasion, Hoffman is addressing an audience of New York businessmen, and they're very skeptical about the idea of sending vast sums of taxpayer dollars over to Europe. Some Republican figures in Congress are calling this a vast Rooseveltian giveaway scheme and are hugely opposed to the idea. So Hoffman, when Hoffman begins the address, the businessmen are opposed. By the time he's finished, they stand up, a standing ovation, and they're for it. And one of the businessmen turns to another and he says, "I just wish Hoffman would get out of government." And the other, surprised, turns to him and he says, "Why on earth do you say that?" And he says, "He's such a good salesman, I just love to buy something from him." Richard Bissell may be best known to you for his time in the CIA as one of the masterminds behind the Bay of Pigs debacle or the failed assassination attempts to kill Castro, but he was the economic genius who was responsible for many of the Marshall Plan's most innovative and effective policies. Finally, Averill Harriman will also be a name familiar to most of you. He was one of the world's most respected financiers and diplomats. Harriman was chosen by Truman to be America's diplomat for the Marshall Plan in Europe. He was extremely effective in that role in those years. The Marshall Plan was not perfect, certainly. Mistakes were made. At times we stumbled. There were great political, geopolitical, economic obstacles, currents working against the plan, and at times it really looked as if the whole thing would buckle and fail. And that's important to acknowledge, and that has to be the story, and it is part of the story I told. Still, though, in about the span of 3 years from Marshall's speech on June 5th, 1947, to the start of the Korean War, the Marshall Plan launched the most prolonged economic boom in Western European history. It helped to lay the basis for European integration and the EU to follow, creating a period of peace and prosperity in Europe that few dared would have dreamed of so soon after the war and all of its problems. It helped to give birth to the most effective peacetime military alliance in world history in the form of NATO. It also helped to give birth to two of the most creative acts of statesmanship, I think, in modern history, the Berlin Airlift and the Schuman Plan. The Marshall Planners made it clear this was not a charity. It was much more than an aid program. It was, in fact, the linchpin in America's post-war grand strategy of containing the Soviet Union. It helped to calcify the division between the East and the West. It helped to trigger the Cold War, but it also helped to bring about a configuration of power that helped America eventually to win it. It's notable, in my view, that we did these things. The Marshall Plan achieved these aims through economic instruments, through creative diplomacy, and through institution building. Not one bullet fired, not one life lost. And it's for those reasons why, in my judgment, the Marshall Plan is perhaps the most effective peacetime foreign policy program in American history. There are a few principles, I think, which accounted for the plan's success, and I'll share a few. The first is that when Marshall spoke at Harvard, he made it clear that the enemy was not the Soviet Union as such, but the conditions upon which communism and the Soviet Union were finding weakness and finding strategic gain through. So Marshall did not say we're going to fight the Soviet Union. He said we are going to take aim at hunger, poverty, desperation, and chaos. It was a non-military approach to a security threat. And in that sense, it evinced vision and imagination. The second is Marshall made it clear in that speech that America was not going to impose solutions on Europe. He said America would not draw up a program for European economic recovery unilaterally. This is the business of the Europeans, he said. America would offer instead an invitation to Europe to assume the initiative in its own recovery. We would stand with Europe as partners to that end, underwrite the endeavor, and work with them hand in hand to devise the most innovative solutions to promote recovery. That was extremely important for at least two reasons. The first is that Marshall and the Marshall planners knew that this had to be a break with the failed foreign aid programs of the past and had to deliver Europe to a point of economic self-sustainability. And in order to do that, Europe had to reclaim control of its own destiny. They had to own its own recovery. So that was important. The second thing is that we must remember that these were the ancient, the storied European empires that had been running the international system for hundreds of years. And now they were desperately weak. Empires were dissolving. They were in dire straits economically. These were unstable environments politically. And here to the West, Europe's progeny, America, this upstart, is now in the position of bailing them out, of providing aid. So the psychological dimension was extremely important. Pride mattered, and Marshall's approach paid service to that. So the plan also reflected a sense of cooperation and humility, also hugely important. There were great political obstacles to the plan's passage. There was a Republican in 46. The Republicans took Congress, both houses, decisively. The Democrats had owned the White House for about four terms now, and there was a great deal of political opposition. There had been foreign aid programs, about three or four big ones. In fact, America had spent in aiding Europe an amount roughly equivalent to the whole Marshall Plan, even before the plan, in the form of piecemeal aid. So there was a sense of aid fatigue. And of course, we just come out of World War II, where Americans had come together to sacrifice as never before. There was rationing. Women are going into the workforce. Of course, men and boys are away dying. So almost every American family is touched by this and the sacrifice. And really, there's a period of about 15 years of sacrifice, considering the Depression of the 30s and then wartime. So America wanted a peace dividend. It was wary of assuming additional foreign commitments. And so you have all these obstacles working against the plan. And so bipartisanship becomes hugely important. It needs Republican support to pass. It was made possible by Arthur Vandenberg and a bunch of his colleagues, a tremendous collaborative relationship that Van had with George Marshall, men who put the national interest above party. To run the plan, Harry Truman brought on the best, the most capable Americans available. From a broad cross-section of society. They were labor leaders, government officials, economists, journalists. Perhaps most importantly, they were businessmen, people who had run things, people who had proven competencies. They were pragmatists, not ideologues. A Republican is running it, and many businessmen are part of it. And that also made a huge difference to the effectiveness of the program. Finally, to create a broad base of popular support. When after Marshall's speech, polling showed that most Americans were actually opposed to this idea because of some of the things I cited before. So to go out and to draw Americans in and to create a foundation of support, the Marshall planners, as well as local leaders, civic leaders, and others, actually barnstormed the country in what was really a vast democratic conversation. They went out in America's largest cities and its smallest towns, and they spoke about the plan. They spoke about the need for it, and they made it clear what sort of sacrifice was being asked of the American people. And in that sense, they summoned Americans to an experience of shared national sacrifice. And when it was over, Americans responded. And that foundation of popular support was, in fact, critical for the plan in achieving its immediate congressional approval, as well as the support it would need in successive years for funding. I think that the Marshall Plan, it's important to remember, was unique to its time and place. We often hear we need a Marshall Plan for everything from global warming to AIDS in Africa to Afghanistan to Iraq, you name it, and someone wants to throw a Marshall Plan at it as the sort of cure-all. And I think it's important to remember that this was of a certain time and did address a certain set of challenges. Having said that, I do think that the plan's principles, the insights, the things that made it work are very applicable to the challenges and opportunities of our own time in, for instance, Iraq, in the Middle East, in Iran, in addressing some of our problems in Africa, et cetera. And I'd be happy to elaborate on that a little further later on. But for now, this was a time when America's national ideals were given expression in our foreign policy. It was America at its best, a time in which our foreign policy at once advanced our strategic interests and reflected our moral leadership and the best of our national ideals. It was a special time to be an American, and I think that it's a good time now to remember it and perhaps to reflect upon it. I enjoyed writing the book very much, and it's a pleasure to share it with you and to be with you here this evening. So thank you.
Greg, I'm going to move to the back of the room, and I invite those who would like to ask questions, and I certainly encourage everyone here who has a question to ask it, but all of those should queue up in the back of the room, and I will take everyone in order. But as I move to the back of the room, let me prime the pump with one question. At the end of your talk, you remarked that other people have talked about Marshall Plans for every other ill in the world. But there were a lot of things that were very distinctive, not only about the time, but about the components of the plan. It seems to me that one of the conditions that was unique was that the people who were running many of the businesses in Europe and many of the banks and many of the programs were the same people who'd been in those positions before the war. And it was possible to resume commercial relationships and other banking relationships and other relationships that had been interrupted by the war, but it was possible to resume them, work with people that you trusted. What were some of the other characteristics of the time that were unique and we should look for but may not be replicated in the current circumstances?
Part of the reason why, that's a great question. Part of the reason why the plan was able to be successful is because the near-term imperative was a financial crisis. Europe, in fact, after the war, had moved forward with an incipient recovery. I think that there were still, and there's a good deal of disagreement amongst historians about, was Europe really recovering? Could Europe have been okay without the Marshall Plan? And it's clear that there was an incipient recovery. But in my view, that was really, there was still great structural economic weakness, and Europe did need Marshall aid. But the financial crisis which we responded to was, in order to fuel that recovery, Europe needed goods. It needed import goods from America, but it couldn't produce to pay for those goods. So there was a great balance of payments deficit that emerged, and these European empires were beginning to go bankrupt, possibly. So America, that was a way where America could really step into the breach and help bridge that deficit. So that was a unique condition, a financial condition, which was really the imperative. But then, of course, the plans had much greater ambition than just to sort of finance this deficit for some time. It wanted to help to remake the continent. It believed that Europe couldn't go on as this patchwork of disparate economies that wasn't economically viable. It helped lead to political conflict. There was an ambition to integrate Europe and to help launch it on a path of economic and political integration and unification. So there were these and I think another thing which the plan did, in addition to addressing the financial dimension, is it helped promote modernization. And in countries like France, it financed the Monnet Plan. And France had not been spending on economic modernization, on replenishing plant equipment, capital. And the Marshall Plan really made that possible and helped launch some of these countries on a path towards modernization, integration, which accounted for this extraordinary 30-year economic boom.
Would you discuss the role of Truman in this whole issue? I would have to assume that he had strong support for this and that it probably did enhance his popularity and prestige. But would you discuss this a little more?
There's
deeply?
A great story about Truman and his role in this. Truman, Clark Clifford, who was who was Truman's chief political aide, realizes after Marshall's speech that, this may be something special, and it may have political currency in an election year, and it may have some value as a legacy item for Truman. So Clifford says, you got to call it the Truman Plan. And Truman says, no way. And he says that for two major reasons. The first is that George Marshall really is, even Truman says, the great figure of this age. It's hard to remember how revered Marshall was. Walter Beadle Smith, who was a general in World War II and later the American ambassador of the Soviet Union, is called to testify, and he was someone who I think had a healthy view of his abilities and his importance, and was known as sort of a salty guy. So he was called to testify in Congress, and he was asked about Marshall, a general in World War II and America's ambassador to the Soviet Union. And Beadle Smith says, me commenting on General Marshall is like the molehill commenting on the mountain. So there is Marshall has incredible prestige. Marshall organizes these ticker tape parades for Eisenhower, Patton, that we see now in newsreels, these dramatic ticker tape parades. And these are the men who report to him. There was no parade for Marshall, though. He didn't want it. He just wanted to retire peacefully to his home in Virginia, Dodona Manor. And I think that for Truman, this was a chance to honor Marshall, and someone he revered and someone who deserved it. And really, the planning and the effort was coming out of state. George Elsie's memoirs came out when I was researching this, and Elsie had a powerful quote, which I think sets the historical record, makes it very clear. He said, I must be clear. The White House supported this, but this was really a State Department effort. And I think that's one of the things that the book is able to conclude. The other thing is that you have a Republican Congress. And in an election year, Truman says, if this thing goes to Congress, the Hill, with my name on it, it's going to quiver and die a very quick death. We're going to name it after George Marshall, the greatest living American. And they did, and it worked rather well. And Truman deserves a good deal of credit for his political acumen and his modesty.
I wonder if you could give us some idea of the magnitude of the resources that were transferred from the United States to Europe. I remember recalling a figure of something like 6% of GDP per year in the height of that Marshall Plan, which would be an enormous transfer if that were the case.
Thank you. Right. Thank you. Well, it was $13 billion back then. And in terms of Europe's GDP, of course, it ran the gamut. In a country like Greece, in fact, that was going through a civil war during this time, Marshall aid actually accounted for as much as half of Greece's gross national product. In countries like Britain, it was usually around 2 or 3%. In France, I think it was around 6 or 7% for the first couple of years. And in American terms, the plant, $13 billion in today's dollars would be about $100 billion. But as a comparable percentage of GNP, so during the Marshall Plan years, in aggregate, we spent something like 1% of our GNP. If we did that now for the same period of time, it would be a figure well in excess of $500 billion, probably closer to $600 or $700 billion. So an extraordinary commitment from American taxpayers at a time in which they had no idea if this thing would work. They had just been through a depression and a war. They didn't know what was going to happen to their economy. And the last thing they wanted to do is to assume another great foreign commitment. And so I think you have a sense there of the sacrifice that the American people made.
Sort of to follow up on that question, Greg, my own recollection is that most of the money, perhaps 90% of the money that was appropriated for the Marshall Plan was actually spent in the United States, with United States manufacturers of goods that were shipped overseas, but most of the money went to Americans.
You're correct, and we discussed that earlier. And Paul Hoffman, when the plan was over, Paul Hoffman, the man who ran it, and Hoffman later became the first director of a program called United Nations Development Program, UNDP, where he served for 15 years. So as the guy who ran the Marshall Plan and the first director of the UNDP, Fortune magazine called Hoffman the father of foreign aid. And when this was over, Hoffman's one great regret was he said most Americans still view this as a great charity. And it in fact was no such thing. Altruism was a part of it, but it was not an altruistic act. It was in America's strategic interest, our security interest, and our economic interest. And Marshall planners made it very clear when they went out to talk to people that our economy was booming and we needed Europe as a viable export market. We needed Europe as a trading partner. They spoke to skeptical business audiences and trade groups and things like that, and they said, this is going to be, in fact, a great investment. We're going to be spending a lot of dollars, but we're going to be able to sell a lot of our goods. And in fact, we did. And despite the concerns, America's economy boomed through this period.
Enjoyed your talk immensely. And of course, it could lead to 2 hours of questions. But despite the nobility that you referred to, and you just talked about our economic interests and trading partners and whatnot, can you tease out, since you've looked at everything on this topic, the degree to which this really was primarily an initial act to fight the Cold War? It's my impression that that was really rather important primary. Can you balance that a little bit more for us?
It's exactly right. There was a strategic imperative. America fought World War II, of course, to defeat the Axis powers, but there was a larger strategic imperative. It was the idea that a totalitarian power could not control the Eurasian landmass. It would have too much in the way of resources, too much power, too much breadth. It could really run the world at that point. And what we found is the situation where we fought so hard and we sacrificed so much to defeat the Nazis, and of course Germany was totally defeated. But now, so soon after the war, you have the Soviet Union, which moves into that vacuum and threatens to do exactly what we fought to prevent Germany from doing. And that was really, at the core, the threat that Marshall and the planners were responding to. American security interests. Economics plays a part in it. There was a humanitarian imperative. Of course, people wanted to help Europeans. That even 60 years back then, that the ties, transatlantic ties, were that much stronger. So all of those things came into play, but it really was American security interests, the national interests, which gave rise to the plan.
I'd be interested to, I know that you spoke about the humility that the Americans had going into Europe and these people who had been in control of the international scene overall and the humility that they had. Maybe some specific instances of their humility in dealing with specific businesses. And also, you spoke about Greece and the aid that they gave to them in their Marshall Plan and how that humility might be a little bit contradicted because they were going into an ancient sphere of influence that was not their own at all.
It's a great question. I'm glad you asked about that because it's one of the dimensions which might be easy to overlook but really did help account for the plan's success. And I think is also of particular salience right now, given the state of the world and some of the posture of our foreign policy. And I think the great example is simply that Marshall said that America's not going to do this. This isn't going to be a plan designed in Washington, imposed upon Europeans. We are simply going to offer a hand in partnership. And they wanted Europe to assume the reins. They wanted them to receive all the credit. The offer is made to Europe to take the initiative, and they said the one condition is that these European countries had to come together to devise a common program for their recovery because of integration, as I'd said, and a few other reasons. And so Marshall is asked at a press conference, well, now what's going to happen? What are they going to do? What's America going to do? How much are they going to give him? And Marshall said, the Europeans have taken the initiative. Now let's let them get on with the job. And that was it. He wouldn't take any further questions, and there was a real sense of humility, of partnership. It emboldened the Europeans. It gave them a huge psychological confidence boost at a time in which there was so much danger and peril and so much fragility. And it really it, it it came into play as well through the sort of caliber of people that we brought on as Marshall planners and sent to Europe. They had great language skills. They knew Europe. They'd done business with Europeans. They knew, you know, they respected the continent. They loved the continent. They were very careful in the language they used, always trying to put their counterparts in Europe in front, in the limelight, giving them credit. And it was that sort of approach, I think, which was so important and really why, you know, it helped make this a great endeavor. Was one of the reasons why it was not only effective, but why there was a nobility to it, and why it increased America's standing so much. It's not just, you know, you sort of think we were providing all this aid, Europe ought to be so grateful. But the interesting thing is, you know, I noticed that one French economist, he had a quote. He said, you know, gratitude is the hardest burden to bear. It's difficult to receive aid, to be dependent. So the tone that you take makes all the difference. And that's something we got right back then.
Insofar as you posit that the Marshall Plan was specific in its design to the post-World War II, how much, or to what extent, rather, do you think that it was a response to the problems after World War I? And more importantly, did Truman and Marshall see it as a response to the problems of World War I? And were there any specific provisions in the plan to address the problems that came after World War I?
Thanks. That's a great question. Well, it was. You know, we had the Treaty of Versailles. It was a punitive peace. We had punished Germany. We'd taken a huge amount of reparations. We'd eviscerated it. And in that weakness, you know, there were the seeds for totalitarianism and radicalism. And it helped breed sort of the dislocation in Europe that helped lead to World War II. So people were determined to learn from the mistakes of the post-World War I settlement. And this was something Harry Truman was fond of saying. This was something that had never been done in history, that in fact we are going to now build up our defeated power, the aggressor in the war. We're now going to stand with them and build them up. And part of it came from the post-World War I experience. Part of it also came from the experience of Reconstruction after the Civil War. Harry Truman remembered well in Missouri, looked out and saw you know, what happened to people after the Civil War. Lucius Clay in Germany came from a very prestigious Southern family. He knew about how you know, difficult and corrosive it was to occupy people, to keep them down. And they knew that the best thing they could do, the most productive, stabilizing thing they could do, was to build Germany back up, build Italy back up, but to do it in a constructive, effective way so that they could help steer those countries into a cooperative, you know, constructive order. And it was a great insight and served us well.
I enjoyed your presentation very much. I have read that the Soviet Union was invited to join at the outset of the plan. Is that true? And if it is true, what are the implications of that as far as the Cold War is concerned?
It's a great point. It's absolutely true. After Marshall makes a speech, probably his biggest quandary is, what do we do about the Soviet Union? They're still allies at this point. They're still supposed to be. The relationship is very strained, but they're supposed to be cooperation. And so if America invites Western Europe to participate but doesn't invite the Russians or the Eastern European countries, we could be viewed as the country that really sort of to calcify the East-West division, the country responsible for dividing the world into two oppositional spheres. And Marshall was very concerned about that. And so were some of his colleagues. George Kennan said, play it straight. He said, invite the Russians to come in. The conditions for participation would mean that the countries would have to undergo a good deal of inspection and open up their economies, and they would also have to cooperate and integrate and come up with common programs. And Kennan didn't believe that the Russians would play under those circumstances. So they did ask the Russians, and in fact, Stalin determined in the end that they wouldn't accept, and the main reason for that is because the security position was so fragile, and he placed so much importance on having these Eastern European states in his zone of influence that he was concerned that if they even showed up at these conferences and moved forward with the plan, they would sort of come under the thrall of the American economy, and he could lose influence with those countries. So he pulled them out. And he did, in fact, the one thing which could have killed the plan, because Marshall and others were hugely concerned that the plan would never pass Congress, because Congress wasn't about to send billions of dollars of taxpayer money over to the Russians and the communists. And so Averill Harriman says, you know, Uncle Joe has saved us again. And he's done the one thing that could have killed the plan.
Thank you very much for an excellent presentation on this period. And I would be curious to hear your views on where you feel the tipping point was immediately following the Second World War. Our policies, particularly toward Germany, were highly punitive. They were reminiscent of the period after the First World War. I'm referring to the JCS directives, to the policy on German industry, and those types of policies. The Marshall Plan represented a clear reversal toward that policy. And could you define in some manner where that tipping point was? I mean, the reasons were obvious that we were risking losing political influence in Europe at the time with the gains that the communists had made.
Right. It's hard to say exactly. And people who are, you know, German specialists who really focused on it may have a more precise answer, and I'm sure it's been taken up in a lot of the literature. But I think in 47, you know, the view starts to change from Hoover, from some people in the War Department, from Averill Harriman, that maybe we've got to begin. Problems are so severe in Western Europe and depend so much on Germany's industrial capacity that maybe we've got to begin to build Germany up. But of course, you know, you can guess the country in the world who was absolutely petrified of that. It was France. France had been at war with Germany three times in the last three generations. It had been coming off of a humiliating German occupation only a few years after. So there was a very difficult tension, a difficult line that Americans had to walk in even talking about rehabilitating Germany. That was France's all-consuming fear. But I think what happened is that when Marshall realized that we had to build Western Europe up, we had to provide some economic stability and to bring Western Europe in our sphere as an economic and political partner, the question became, how do you do that? And it became clear that Germany had to be an economic engine in order to bring Europe back. And Americans moved carefully, adroitly to do that, to sort of build Germany up, and it was fitful. I mean, it took several conferences and negotiations with France, and it was sort of an iterative process. But I think the time when America moved forward decisively was really, you know, shortly probably after Marshall's speech. Thank
you. As one who was in Berlin at the time Marshall came back from his meeting with Stalin, and who told General Clay that things were going to have to change, I can appreciate a lot of the things you're talking about in 1947 of what happened after that. And my question is, written or unwritten, weren't there two political understandings for countries that wanted to join the Marshall Plan? One of them was that the communists would not be allowed in their governments. And as I recall, France and Italy both had communists in their coalition governments after the war. And the second unwritten understanding, I think, was that Germany and France would have to make up. They would have to bury the hatchet, and this was one way to do that.
Yes, absolutely on the first one. It's true. There were, you know, this was, for all the nobility and the altruism, we had a clear political agenda, and we did make it clear to France and Italy that we did not think communists ought to be welcome in coalition governments. They you know, subsequently pushed them out. Absolutely. There's a very dramatic election in Italy in April of 48, in which we were very concerned that the communists might win. It was just after the plan was passed through Congress and was going to be a really, you know, a decisive, a really important election in Europe. And America, we played in that election. The CIA was active in giving funds to various political parties. We sent over videos with Frank Sinatra singing to sending greetings from Italian Americans. We encouraged Italian Americans to write letters over. So we were pretty involved in that election, even as we scolded the Soviets for interfering in their Eastern European satellites. So you're right, very much on the first one. I don't know if the second was conditional, the idea that France and Germany had to make up and be partners. We realized that was asking, we clearly wanted that, and we made that clear, but I think we also knew that it was asking too much of France to accept that immediately, to accept rapprochement and to move forward as partners immediately. So we really began pushing, at times gently, at times more forcefully. And the tipping point there really was when Britain opts out of European integration. And at the same time, we realize we have to build Germany up. And so now we really begin to push France more and more to take the lead. And France realizes that America's not going to stop to build Germany up, and they better assume the initiative before Germany outpaces them. And what happens is in May of 1950, France and Germany actually do something extraordinary. They had been, again, at war three times in the past three generations, coming off of an occupation. They agree to pool their coal and steel resources, their most valuable resources, and move together on a path towards economic and political integration. And to me, that is one of the most extraordinary political accomplishments probably in world history. And I think that you look at the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and other tensions which seem insoluble, but to me, if the most most destructive interstate rivalry probably in world history can take that sort of bend, I find some inspiration in that. So, thank you.
In ninth grade civics, they taught us this was a government of the people. So I was very interested in your delineation and operationalization of the leadership that made this possible. Do you have anything you could offer about the response of the American people? Were they in line with this? How did the leaders cooperate with the people? How did they engender their support for this? And you said not to try to translate this to current times, but I'm very curious about the dynamic between our current leadership and our current populace.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think you had a group of statesmen who were pretty remarkable. You had George Marshall. We discussed his compliments. Dean Acheson was also someone of incredible abilities. George Kennan was possibly the greatest strategic mind, greatest strategic thinker that we've ever had. I think that this cast of statesmen is probably second only to the founding fathers in terms of their abilities and their vision. And so I'm sometimes asked sort of why is that? And I guess, who knows, really? I mean, part of it may just be fortuitous, but I think part of it has to also be that these men came off of the experience of World War II, a period in which there was the ethos of service and sacrifice, and that everything hung in the balance. I mean, you had a period of 15 years with the Depression and World War II where really, it's not hyperbolic to say everything hung in the balance. And so they realized the immediacy, and they had this ethos of service and sacrifice, and I think that has to be part of it. And that gets back to your question, which is what was the relationship between leaders and people? I think people responded to the quality and the depth of our leadership back then. This was something, it now seems somewhat obvious maybe that we'd come to Europe's aid, of course we'd put forward this big program and things would work out well. But this was something which had never been done before in human history. It was audacious. Even its champion said, look, we don't know if this is going to work. We just think it's our best shot. And so it was a big leap for American public at a difficult time to support it. But these leaders invested in discussion and education, and they engaged the public vigorously. And I think that created a dynamic where it did have popular support. And that's some of the ways I see the interplay. Thank you.
It's an incredible period. And looking back, hello, everyone just turned around. And looking back, I can feel pride as American and all of the places that it took us. But my question is more along the lines of, what have we learned? And today, this move that was so successful propelled us down this path so surely of optimism. Has that optimism been entirely positive if we look at our foreign policy today? Or did it perhaps influence us in another direction that conversely might be disillusioned?
So, well, I think it's, you ask a, there are a number of different ways to answer that. And I think that experience and the achievements of that time served us very well. I think, I think in a lot of ways that's how we think of ourselves, or a lot of us think of ourselves as Americans. It's as the country of the Marshall Plan, of the Berlin Airlift, of standing for a certain set of ideals, a time which of sacrifice when we did, great transcendent things. And I think that gave us a lot of confidence to see us through the Cold War and all of its challenges, even though we made, mistakes and did hubristic things along the way. And I think, unfortunately, we have not responded. The world changed after World War II. There was a period of where everything was up for grabs, and there was a dramatic realignment in the international political order. And that I think has happened again in the sort of post-Cold War, post 9/11 period. And so what have we learned? I unfortunately don't think we responded to this seminal moment with the same sort of vision and imagination and the values of cooperation and humility, the same sort of discussion amongst leaders in the American public. I think we've had tremendous opportunity, particularly after 9/11, to do those things. And unfortunately, I don't know if we fully absorb the lessons from this period. But my hope now is in reintroducing it, that we maybe can take some of those lessons to help us engage the challenges and opportunities of this time.
Greg, you have also written extensively about some of the humanitarian responses to the AIDS crisis. What is going to be the role of private philanthropic foundations like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, as opposed to the role of government in responding to humanitarian crises? Has the government just abdicated its responsibility and turned it all over to the private philanthropic sector?
That's a great question. I think in some of these humanitarian crises, like health and AIDS crisis in Africa, for example, you see great acts of altruism, of leadership, of vision from the private sector. Bill and Melinda Gates, Warren Buffett, President Clinton in his post-presidency has been a leader on it. You have the Bono, the rock star. There's actually, I wrote this book on America's response to AIDS in Africa, and there's one moment in which I recount President Clinton is meeting with Bill Gates at the Waldorf Astoria, and it's during the Clinton administration. Of course, the Justice Department had been giving Microsoft a hard time for monopolistic antitrust legislation, being a monopolist. And so this is the first sort of meeting between Clinton and Gates since all of this has happened. And so as Clinton walks in the room, the atmosphere is a little frosty. But as they begin to talk, they sort of lighten up. And Clinton sort of leans back and he says, I actually was just at dinner with Bono last night, and he was sort of giving me some great tips on what to do. And they sort of the room bursts into laughter. And then Clinton, leans back and says, maybe an impeached president, a monopolist, and an aging rock star can do something about this. and so it speaks to the role of the private sector and some of the leadership. But unfortunately, I do think because of the magnitude of some of these problems, it does take government leadership. The problems are so big, and the response has to be so big that government has to lead, and there's a great role for private citizens and private groups to play. But in the AIDS crisis in Africa, for example, there has to be dramatic infrastructure development, physical infrastructure, human capacity, and that's going to take an amount of capital and amount of time where government is going to have to lead. So that's my take.
Greg Berman will be signing copies of The Most Noble Adventure, The Marshall Plan and the Time When America Helped Save Europe, following the forum. And I ask that everyone remain in their places to give Greg the opportunity to get out front to the selling and signing station. And please join me in thanking Greg Berman.